if it were just a 25% across-the-board cut, it could really slow things down.
Proposed cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency could impact resource development. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, school districts across the state warn against plans to cut school bond debt reimbursements.
The responsibility then resides back on local government.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
President Trump is giving his first formal address to Congress tonight. His first budget proposal is expected in mid-March, and it reportedly includes a 25% cut to the Environmental Protection Agency. That's music to the ears of many Republicans and many Alaskans who feel the EPA has overstepped its bounds. There's no word yet on where exactly the budget acts will fall within the agency, but Alaska has a lot at stake. The state received $78 million last year from the EPA in grants and contracts, according to usaspending.gov, and cutting EPA's regulatory side could have unintended consequences.
If it were just a 25% across-the-board cut, it could really slow things down.
John Yanni was EPA Regional Administrator for Region 10, including Alaska, during the George W. Bush presidency. Yanni says deep cuts could diminish certainty for regulated industries.
Certainty means that permits get published and environmental work gets done so that projects can proceed. And I think what happens when you just slash budgets, things come to a grinding halt, and that's a problem.
Yanni also says diminished environmental enforcement could leave projects vulnerable to lawsuits. Citizens can sue polluters under the Clean Water and Clean Air Acts. A spokeswoman for the Alaska Oil and Gas Association says it's too early for the industry group to comment, since the Trump administration hasn't identified which parts of the EPA budget would be cut. Also today, President Trump signed an executive order to begin the process of rewriting an EPA regulation known as Waters of the U.S. WOTUS, a proud achievement of the Obama administration, is at or near the top of the Alaska congressional delegation's dislike list. The administrative process to revise it could take 2 years. Alaskans would pay more in property taxes if the state government cuts the amount it pays to offset the debt to build schools. A House committee included a nearly $50 million cut in state aid during a step in rewriting the state budget today. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on the debate over the move.
The state government historically paid 60-70% of the cost of bond payments to build schools, with local property owners footing the rest of the bill. Homer Republican Representative Paul Seaton proposed cutting the state payment in half. He notes the state has a nearly $3 billion gap between what it spends and raises in oil royalties, taxes, and fees. And he would rather cut spending on bonds than on teachers and other classroom costs.
I think that everybody has been talked to and knows that education, K-12 education, is one of the biggest components of our budget.
Fairbanks Republican Representative Steve Thompson says communities will have no choice but to either raise property taxes or make cuts to other services.
This was like a contract with our constituents saying, okay, state, you pay this much and we're going to pay the difference. Now we're going to shove it back onto the community.
Governor Bill Walker vetoed a quarter of school debt payments after the legislature failed to pass a comprehensive plan to balance the budget in the long term last year. This prompted an outcry from local school and municipal officials who hadn't budgeted for the cuts. While Walker didn't include the cuts in this year's budget proposal, Seaton says passing it now gives communities time to plan ahead. Anchorage School Superintendent Dina Bishop says all school cuts present bad choices, but the debt payment cut affects only those who live in boroughs. The state pays all school debt in the unorganized borough.
It's the ugly, the ugly, and the ugly. So, I mean, to pick this over anything else, especially for really any municipality or borough, is significant because the responsibility then resides back on local government.
Anchorage would lose $18.5 million of the nearly $44 million it expected to receive. While state laws provided for the state to pay 60 to 70% of school bonds, whether the state actually pays the full amount is subject to annual appropriation. The state is in the middle of a five-year break in paying for the new school bonds. When the program returns in 2020, state law says the state will pay 40 to 50% of new bonds. The House Finance Committee amended the budget to reflect the cut, but the committee still must review the entire spending plan before it recommends it to the full House. Then the budget goes to the full legislature for a vote. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The state is asking oil and gas company Hillcorp to dramatically step up environmental monitoring near a natural gas leak in Cook Inlet. The Department of Environmental Conservation says the company needs to be prepared to evacuate the line, which could include shutting down wells by March 13th, depending on monitoring results. The leak, discovered earlier this month, is releasing natural gas at a rate of 210,000 to 310,000 cubic feet per day, according to Hillcorp. The company says ice conditions in Cook Inlet won't allow for repairing the line until mid to late March. A letter DEC sent yesterday to the company says it's imperative Hillcorp begin monitoring for potential fish and wildlife impacts and perform regular air and water quality sampling. The state is asking the company to use trained observers to look for dead fish, birds, and marine mammals in the area. Cook Inlet is critical habitat for an endangered population of beluga whales. Hillcorp has until March 8th to come up with a monitoring plan. The company didn't immediately respond to a request for comment to the letter. An Anchorage Jewish community center is among those targeted in a wave of bomb threats around the country. The Luavitch Jewish Center of Alaska evacuated about 40 children after it received a phone call making the threat Monday afternoon. Rabbi Yosef Greenberg says a recorded male voice announced there was a bomb in the building and that people had 20 minutes to clear out. He says police arrived within minutes and the FBI also responded. No explosives were found anywhere on the premises, including in Greenberg's car, whose alarm began blaring around the same time as the call. Police referred other questions to the FBI, which didn't immediately respond for comment today. Jewish centers and day schools in at least a dozen states received threats on Monday. Today, the center issued a statement saying it has received an outpouring of support and thanking the Anchorage community for people who, quote, have our back and care so deeply about us. The Dalton Highway remains closed through Attigan Pass in the Brooks Range. Alaska Department of Transportation Northern Region spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says gates were lowered late Monday, closing off the road between mileposts 241 and 247 as heavy snow and high winds heightened avalanche conditions.
And as our crews were heading south to close the gate, they came to some trucks who had been hit by an avalanche. There were four of them. Two of them were able to get out easily, and two of them are still stuck in the snow.
Bailey says the truck drivers are okay, but a little shaken, noting they routinely traverse the Dalton Highway to supply North Slope oil fields and are accustomed to extreme conditions.
They'll send us, you know, photos of floods and snowstorms and things that would make the average driver nervous. And so to have them go through this and say it was really scary, that really speaks about how unusual this is.
The winter weather advisory for blowing snow remains in effect until Wednesday morning, after which Bailey says state maintenance crews will go in and conduct avalanche control and cleanup operations.
So we expect that it'll be closed at least through Wednesday. That completely depends on weather conditions, though. But we're not going to put anybody on the road until we've had a chance to shoot the additional avalanche areas, get that cleared up, and that it's really safe.
Bailey says it's the first time that the Attigan Pass avalanche gates have been closed since being installed 3 years ago. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, after more than five decades, remains of some 19th century Chirikoff Island people have been returned to Alaska.
I'm just happy to find it coming home.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A 19-year-old Wasilla man died after apparently crashing his snow machine in the Talkeetna Mountains. Alaska State Troopers say a private helicopter helped recover the body of Jacob Harris. Troopers on Sunday afternoon received a report of a wreck near a Talkeetna road. Others found Harris beneath his idling snow machine near a steep embankment. They report he was unresponsive and could not be revived. As troopers prepared to respond by snow machine, the private helicopter with a member of Harris's family reached the scene. Snow machiners transported Harris to a location where the helicopter could land and complete the recovery of the body. An autopsy is planned. Alaska has another tool in the fight against opioid abuse. Public health officials are distributing thousands of drug disposal bags that are safe and easy to use. They're sealable pouches containing active carbon. When drugs and water are added, the carbon neutralizes them. The biodegradable bags can be sealed and thrown out with household trash. Michelle Overstreet is executive director of My House, a Wasilla-based organization that helps homeless youth. She told those at a recent Alaska Municipal League meeting in Juneau that it's important to dispose of drugs safely at any time, not just official drop-off days.
We've had parents coming in to get those. We've had grandparents coming in to get those because people are excited about having a way to get rid of those that isn't throwing them in the garbage or down their septic system, which then can leach into their well.
She says they are used to dispose of drugs turned over by those wanting help, as well as those with unused prescriptions, a frequent target of addicts. A company that makes painkillers is contributing 25,000 disposal bags to the state. Officials say they're being distributed to hospitals, clinics, tribal governments, and others who can get them to all parts of Alaska. At the Municipal League meeting, Dr. Jay Butler, the state's chief medical officer, said his agency is sending 1,000 bags to its clinics.
I recognize that some of our public health centers don't have full-time staffing anymore, but that is one of the ways we want to get these into the community, or if we can provide some directly to you, we'd be happy to do that also.
Governor Bill Walker declared the opioid epidemic a state emergency earlier this month. The effort includes distribution of 5,000 naloxone kits, which can stop opioid overdoses. Homer City Council heard a resolution on Monday that would have officially expressed the town's commitment to fighting discrimination and maintaining a safe, inclusive city. Dozens of residents turned out to provide public testimony, highlighting sharp divides within the community. KBBI's Shayla Farzan reports.
It was standing room only at Monday's Homer City Council meeting. Over 100 people packed into Cowles Council chambers and overflowed into the lobby. Many waited over 3 hours to testify on a controversial resolution promoting inclusivity. The resolution, which was co-sponsored by council members Donna Adderholt, Catriona Reynolds, and David Lewis, cited recent violence targeting religious groups, minorities, and the LGBTQ community. It also officially rejected discrimination against any group with regard to, quote, race, religion, ethnicity, gender, national origin, physical capabilities, or sexual orientation. The council rejected the resolution in a 5-1 vote, with Councilmember Reynolds voting in favor. She said she'd seen a recent increase in hate and bullying in the Homer community.
When you aren't the receiving end of abuse because of religion or skin color or sexual orientation, it's easy to think it doesn't happen here, but it does happen here.
Before voting, the council heard 3.5 hours of public testimony from just over 90 people. The majority strongly opposed the resolution, including Homer resident John Butcher.
The fact this room here is filled with people that are here in opposition to this resolution should be a reminder to you that you are elected officials. And as an elected official, your position can be filled with somebody else in the next election cycle if you don't do your job.
Much of the controversy stemmed from a draft resolution posted to social media, which included several clauses critical of President Trump. Those clauses were removed before Monday's council meeting. Coletta Walker argued the resolution would hurt the town's image and negatively affect tourism.
You have done a great harm to this community, and I, for one, am appalled that someone thinks that they need to dictate to me how to be hospitable and community-minded. It is not the responsibility of government to dictate to its people to be kind.
The resolution emphasized the city's commitment to cooperating with federal agencies in detaining undocumented immigrants. But a number of residents expressed concern that it appeared to be advocating for providing sanctuary. Others, like Lindsay Martin, voiced support for the resolution.
I am a Korean-born citizen of the United States who is new to Homer. Positive and welcoming interactions with my fellow Homer citizens make up a majority of my day. However, the negative experiences I have had are significant enough and based in my ethnic identity that I support this resolution.
The Alaska Criminal Code does not define hate crimes as a distinct offense, but the code does allow for the possibility of a more severe sentence if a defendant has knowingly committed a crime against a victim because of that person's race, sex, color, creed, physical or mental disability, ancestry, or national origin. Bias due to sexual orientation is not included on the list. In Homer, I'm Shayla Farzon.
Juneau's privately owned electric utility won't be bringing natural gas to the capital city anytime soon. Alaska Electric Light and Power is owned by the Washington-based company Avista, which had shown interest in shipping liquefied natural gas from British Columbia to Juneau. Tim McLeod, AEL&P's president, says the company thought heating with natural gas could save customers money. A few years ago, natural gas cost half as much as oil, but circumstances have changed.
A barrel of oil has dropped significantly, and so the price of heating fuel in Juneau has reduced the margin between natural gas and heating oil.
McLeod says the project was expected to cost $170 million. That price included the $6,000 cost for switching homes from heating fuel to natural gas. He says Avista couldn't justify the expense at a time when Alaska's economy is shrinking. The capital city has many state employees.
They're not really so worried about trying to find a way to reduce the cost of heating their homes. They're more concerned about, will they have a job in a few years?
McLeod says if the price of oil rebounds and the state's economy gets back on track, natural gas could be an option again for Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Ocean acidification has been big news lately. Experts have spoken about the possible consequences for shellfish and the critters that eat them. But its actual impact in Southeast Alaska is not known. Southeast Alaska Tribal Ocean Research, a network of 15 Southeast tribes, hopes to answer that question. KSTK's Aaron Bolton has more.
Wrangell and 14 other tribes have participated in the Southeast Alaska Tribal Ocean Research Program, collecting clams and conchals for paralytic shellfish poison testing. The Sitka Tribe of Alaska heads the initiative and now wants to get a baseline for ocean acidification in the region. Sitka Tribe environmental specialist Esther Kennedy explains that monitoring ocean acidification in nearshore environments has been quite difficult until recently.
Most of the research on OA to date has been in the open ocean.
These environments naturally have wide swings in ocean chemistry due to stream and river volume changes, storms and droughts, and proximity to the open ocean.
I suspect Sitka is going to look a lot more like the Gulf of Alaska than it will look like Wrangell with its huge freshwater input from the Stikine. One of the things that will be really interesting is, can we start to see, say, gradients in effects of ocean acidification as we move, say, from the outer coast into the even more coastal environments?
The project aims to get a baseline for Southeast waters. Some data will be obtained through a buoy in Sitka Sound that'll measure pH levels and dissolved carbon dioxide in the water, a slice of the many variables measured to indicate ocean acidification. The buoy will help answer the main concern of the environmental issue. How difficult is it for organisms to form a shell?
That plays into the second part of our ocean acidification project, where we are now installing an instrument called a percolator in our lab.
A percolator is a machine that will be constantly taking measurements in one of Sitka's harbors, but will also test samples sent in by 14 tribes across the region. The Wrangell Cooperative Association monitors phytoplankton and collects clam and conchal samples at two popular sites south of town, Shoemaker Bay Harbor and Pat's Creek Landing. Shellfish samples are sent to the lab in Sitka for testing, and the results are dispersed on the program's website. Chris Hatton, WCA's Indian Environmental General Assistance Program Coordinator, says the tribe is excited to participate.
Because we are already going to these locations every week, and sometimes more than once a week, we'll be able to grab a sample in a special brown jar, and then that jar will be stored for a bit and then sent to Sitka, where they can then analyze it for different levels of acidification and other things in the water. It'll be great to get a baseline, because that's where what we don't have yet.
Hatton added she's interested to see how Wrangell's freshwater influence plays out when it comes to ocean acidification and paralytic shellfish poisoning.
With our PSP results, I think we're all realizing that there is the chance, and there are cockles and clams that are higher in PSP than what we recommend for consumption. So our freshwater maybe helps us, but it doesn't keep us safe necessarily.
Kennedy says with such environmental diversity in Southeast, she hopes to use the project's data as a model for other parts of Alaska. Data from the open ocean will be used to tease out the large variabilities of nearshore environments. Kennedy noted measuring ocean acidification will also answer questions about the impacts of fewer shell-forming organisms.
An indirect effect would then be less food for other creatures like crustaceans, which are also going to have some shell-forming difficulties, but also salmon, marine mammals will have a more difficult time finding food.
Kennedy hopes to have the buoy up and running within a month and plans to start testing samples from around the region in September. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Aaron Bolton.
After years of work, ancestral remains from a 19th century settlement on Chirikoff Island have returned home. In the 1960s, archaeologists removed the bones from Chirikoff, which is located southwest of Kodiak Island. And since then, the majority of the bones have been stored and studied at Indiana University in Bloomington. Now they are home in Alaska. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
A group of people hug in the airport foyer. Outside, Aleutic Museum staff is looking forward to another kind of reunion. They're waiting for the arrival of the 51 boxes that contain the Chirikov ancestral remains. Everyone's a little nervous. In the hours before, museum executive director April Lehtonen-Kanzler admits she broke out in hives, and at the moment, she's trying to locate the remains.
The baggage guy said 15 minutes, so I think we're okay.
Kanzler has been working to get the remains back to the island since she took the position in 2015. But the museum's repatriation efforts began in the early 2000s.
I mean, it's really positive, even though I'm emotional. It's just very real now that we're actually seeing the boxes and moving forward.
She says the Aleutic Museum has planned a Russian Orthodox ceremony for the Chirikov ancestors who were Christian.
Although we're not on Chirikov Island, this is part of the same parish, and so the descendants of the Chirikov people are mostly living here on Kodiak today.
Elder Nick Alokli is one of those whose surname can be found among the records of the Chirikov ancestors.
Oh, Nick, really excited. You know, I mean, I'm just happy to finally coming home. Real home. I mean, the real home is up in paradise, but their temporary home was Kodiak Island. And, so I'm glad they're here now, and which really surprised to me because I never thought this would ever happen.
Father Innocent Dresdo sings the prayer, which he explains is traditionally given at the anniversary of a loved one's passing.
Rest eternal in blessed repose.
Descendant Susan Malouden says the service was meaningful and long overdue.
We can just relish in the fact that they're here now, and that's the important thing. And it's not just this group here, but others who have the relatives, they too can find comfort in that now. They too, and that's important.
The repatriation process isn't over yet. Counselor explains the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service still needs to publish the official notice in the Federal Register that will allow the Shunack tribe to make an official claim on the remains, fill out the paperwork, and complete the repatriation. Peterson says they have plans to then reinter the remains. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Annie Fite in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Shayla Farzan in Homer, Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Aaron Bolton in Wrangell, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of operations in Alaska.
And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. The Northwest Arctic Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Kotzebue March 1st and 2nd at the Northwest Arctic Heritage Center from 9 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.